Welcome to our live Building Tips audio podcast. I'm Jay Smith, Editor-in-Chief of Model Aviation Magazine. Model Aviation is the flagship publication for the Academy of Model Aeronautics. If you're not familiar with the AMA and our work in the hobby, you can learn more at www.modelaircraft.org. In Model Aviation's October 2014 issue, we featured many build projects, including an article entitled Top 5 Building Tips. We've invited the contributors to that article, Brian Eberween of Mountain Models, Mark Freeland of Retro RC, and Bill Stevens of Stevens Air Model to join me in this live audio podcast to answer our readers' questions. A live podcast is like a radio show being broadcasted over the internet. Instead of listeners calling in with their questions, they can type in their questions using the chat box on your screen. You can also move the chat box, expand it, or fill it out to fill on your screen, or hide it. We also have dozens of pre-submitted questions that we will also try to address. Today's podcast should last about an hour, and once it's complete, we will also have it available for replay on www.modelaviation.com. So let me first start by introducing our guests. First, we'll have Brian Eberween from Mountain Models. Brian, tell us a little bit about you.
Hi, my name is Brian Eberween, owner of Mountain Models. I've been into modeling since about 6 to 8 years old. Designed my first radio control model of somewhere around 1990 in high school. Worked as a design engineer for Estes Cox and Newell Rubbermaid, and have been running my own RC business now for 10 years. At Mountain Models, we specialize in laser-cut radio control electric airplanes and sailplane kits, ranging from beginner types up through pattern ships. And we strive to get new people into building, keep people building, and bring back those who may have fallen into the instant gratification of ARFs with our well-engineered and thoroughly tested kits, like my other panelist members here.
Thanks, so Brian. Thanks. Next up, Mark Freeland of Retro RC. Could you introduce yourself to our listeners?
Yes. Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Mark Freeland. I am the owner, designer, manufacturer, dishwasher, and sole do-everything person at Retro RC. It's a small home-based business that I started in 2008. My background, I've been modeling for about 48 years. Started in Northern Ireland, moved to England, and then eventually moved to the United States in 1986. Was an automotive engineer with Ford Motor Company for 28 years, and now I find it much more satisfying to give back to the hobby some of the things that I got during my lifetime as an engineer. Again, like Brian, I like to encourage people to build, and one of the ways I do that is to go out to schools and run classes, particularly for 11 to 13 year olds at middle schools. They really seem to have a great time doing that. Keeps them away from the phones and keeps their hands busy with something else other than pressing buttons. Anyway, that's Retro RC. Thanks.
Thank you, Mark. And our third contributor to the article and our live podcast is Bill Stevens of Stevens Air Model. Bill, could you tell us a little about you?
Sure. Yeah, I'm a lifelong modeler. I've been doing this since I was a kid, and I want to say I've been active in the hobby now for a little over 30 years. Started Stevens Aero Model about 12 years ago with a focus on designing easy-to-build, well-engineered kits. I have a background in engineering and geographical information systems of all things. Prior to my employment at Stevens Aero, I worked for the City of Colorado Springs exercising those skills, and over time, actually was able to develop the small business into something that we could do full-time. So that's kind of my position now. The head tire kicker, and web monkey, and design guy here. I do have some help from some other talented local modelers that participate at Stevens Aero as well. So that's kind of what we do.
Thanks, Bill, and thank you all for being part of this podcast. I certainly feel privileged to have you all here with us to talk to our readers about building. And I do want to say before we get started that I do know all three of our contributors here personally, and I've had experience with all three of their aircraft, and they all make wonderful aircraft, and I'm excited what they're going to share with you today. So before we get into the questions, let's just remind our live listeners that they can use the chat box to submit any questions that they have. I will moderate the question, and as time allows, try to ask as many questions as possible. We also have questions that were submitted previously that we also will be going through. So with that, let's go ahead and jump right in. So I wanted to start off with a question that I asked our contributors earlier before we started as a test, but basically everybody always asks about where the best place is to build and or where other people build. So let's kind of get everybody's take on that. So Brian, could you tell us where you build?
I will build on any horizontal surface I have available. I prefer to work on about a 3x5 flat building table that I have in my office, but I will work at my computer desk or my coffee table in the living room if I want to try to listen to the news or watch a show while I'm building. Pretty much anywhere I can. The models we make, you know, the biggest is maybe 6 foot, so it really doesn't take up much room at all. Smaller ones, like a building table that folds up to the wall, also is a nice addition to have for tight spaces that I have. So anywhere I can.
Okay, Mark?
Well, my preferred building location is in my workshop, of course, which is in the basement. But I will build, like Brian, anywhere. Primary requisite for building for me is a flat surface. Nice to have one that's portable so you can move your model that you're building from place to place as you need to. My preferred surface is a small steel shelf, which I purchased in IKEA, 10 inches by 22 inches. It's an ideal size for working on small models like the models that we produce. And I use it with my magnetic building jig system, which is a great addition to keeping your fuselages straight, your wings not warped, and other than that, I'll build on a glass surface. Sometimes I even glue parts or part of my fixtures to the glass surface to help them hold in place while I'm building.
Excellent. And Bill?
I too build in a workshop. Dedicated space is always better if you can find it. I started by building a work table. The EAA, actually, if you look up EAA chapter, I believe it's chapter 1000, they have a great construction article on how you can build your own work table. It's about a 2-foot by 5-foot table. And, you know, for build surface, it's important to have an absolutely flat surface to build on, because your models are only going to turn out as good as the surface you've secured them to. So a 3/4-inch thick piece of particle board skinned with a 1/4-inch of MDF makes a nice smooth surface. Some people like to build over glass, as Mark mentioned. Steel to receive magnets is also an option. But it is nice to have a dedicated area, so if you can find a dedicated area, that's what I would suggest, and that's what we use around here.
Excellent. Thank you. Well, we received a few questions regarding covering, so let's jump into one of those. One of the questions we had were advice or tips on covering an airplane without adding too much weight. Mark?
Well, the weight of your covering really is determined by what covering you select. For lighter models, the covering material that I like to choose is Coverite Coverlite, which is sort of like a tissue paper, but it's a synthetic tissue that you don't have to dough. You can adhere it to your balsa framework either using Coverite's own adhesive system like BalsaLock or BalsaRite. My preferred adhesive is a water-based system from the UK called BalsaLock. You iron the material down to the adhesive that you've pre-applied, and then you heat shrink the material. It's really great material when you're covering an undercambered wing because it has a lot more shrink in the spanwise direction than it does in the chordwise direction. I much prefer that to one of the plastic films.
Okay. What about Brian or Bill? Do you have anything to add?
It depends on what size of model you're building or the construction style of the model. For instance, if you're building a small, say, 24, 36-inch old Comet-style plane, you're not going to want to use anything that shrinks too much because that's going to tend to warp. If the structure is such that it's designed to avoid warping, then you can use slightly heavier coverings. But it really is dependent on the size of plane you're using. For instance, you're not going to cover a small 24-inch plane with silk. But if you're building a 6-foot plane and you like that look, then silk's probably going to be fine as long as the structure is designed to accept that. So it really depends on the size of the model and your application.
Yeah, and I think I would add to that also your intended purpose for the model and the flying site. Coming from a stick and tissue background, I use Aerolite quite extensively as a nice replacement for tissue weight-wise. I'll use Aerolite on models up to about a pound and a half, 2 pounds, and many have even been known to use it on larger models. The film being lightweight, it's also quite fragile if you put your model down into the brush at the edge of the field. So if you're flying off of some scrubby conditions, you know, you don't have the luxury of a nice mowed Kentucky bluegrass strip to land in, you might want to reach for something a little more durable. A thicker polyester, polypropylene film would be something to look at using in a situation like that. So also take into account your flying site and the intended purpose of the model.
I'd like to add one other thing to that. I have some models that have survived for 20, 30, and even 35 years. They're all covered with some kind of fabric. If you want your model to last a long, long time and take a lot of abuse, fabric covering is way better than a plastic covering. However, they do tend to be heavy, with one exception. There's a kite fabric that is used extensively by free flight modelers, and it weighs about 3/4 of an ounce per square yard. I use it for most of my contest models. And again, you just use it like a tissue, you stick it on with an adhesive, and then you heat shrink it with the iron.
Excellent, thank you. Well, while we're on the topic of covering, another question from Andrew Rice was, if you could provide tips on covering techniques in covering curved shapes.
Sure, I'll go ahead and say a little on that.
Okay.
Basically, go slowly. You can, using Solite or Aerolite, like Bill sells, you can cover a tennis ball and end up with a half-inch handle at the end, as long as you hold some tension with one hand and work the covering with your other hand and the iron. So you just slowly pull it in each direction, and you can pull it back and forth slightly to make sure you get all the wrinkles out, and just go very slowly and just work the covering with one hand while you're ironing it down, and you can cover amazingly complex shapes.
Thanks, Brian. Mark or Bill, do you want to add anything to that?
Yeah, I tend to agree with that. You can certainly heat the covering, give yourself plenty of handle on the covering and heat it and pull it across a complex shape. On some compound curves where you have a real complicated compound curve, it may be beneficial to go ahead and to slice that covering into multiple segments try to take on the project that way, as opposed to trying to get it all on one sheet. So, again, I think the complexity of the curve and the size of the model, you'll just kind of have to make those determinations for yourself. But it's good advice either way. You can certainly, with the lighter polypropylene coverings, you can cover some amazingly complex shapes, as Brian stated.
I think Bill and Brian have it totally covered. Pull, pull, pull on the fabric or the plastic film, and you can get it run curves.
Okay. It looks like one of our listeners asked a question for Mark. They were asking what the name of the kite fabric was that you mentioned, Mark. They missed the name of it.
It is, my mind's gone blank for a second. Give me, I'll get back with you on that, or if you'd like to send me an email, it's actually available on my website, and it, Icarix is the name.
Okay, thank you. Let's move on a minute into Glue, and we had numerous participants ask about going over the different types of glue and where you might apply them. You want to start us off with that, Brian?
I'll go ahead and let Bill start this one off. He's much better, or much more informed about glues than I am.
Okay.
I'm not saying he's the resident glue stiffer.
is that a dig against how much I have to put my stuff back together?
No, absolutely not.
Yeah, okay. So glues, there's a few basic types. Typically, you have CA glue or super glue. You have your aliphatic glues, like your wood glues, tight bonds, and you have epoxy. And those are the three main styles of glue that we use in the business. And each has kind of its own property and cure time. But briefly, when using, let's start with CA. We need to recognize that CA is a fast-setting glue. It comes in various viscosities, from watery thin to very thick, almost like a gel thick. The set times vary from several seconds to upwards of a minute. CA glue can be, the set time can be influenced using an accelerator. It will rapidly accelerate the curing of the glue. But the main property of CA glue, and perhaps what will give you pause to think about using it in construction, would be it's a very fragile, very brittle glue. And so the bond it makes is quite fragile, it's quite brittle. We go on to real quick here to epoxy. Epoxy is a two-part product. You're going to mix an A and B part together. It has a certain working time. We call it a pot time. Once you've mixed the A and B together, that you have time to work and apply the epoxy to your parts before your pot hardens and the glue cures. Hobby shops offer it in 5, 15, 30, I've seen an hour. There's also finishing rosins that might have upwards of 3 hours of pot life. That all depends on how quickly you want to work. Epoxy is a very flexible glue, so we'll keep that in mind. But then we also have your tight bond, and of course I've glossed over your wood cements like Duke of Cement and Ambroid, but your wood glues like Type Bond, Elmer's White Glue, and even Elmer's Wood Glue, they create a bond that's also quite flexible. So keeping that in mind, we got to look at the cure time, the set time for those glues, and use the glue appropriately. A lot of the kits that all three of us manufacture use CA quite extensively throughout. I think that has to do primarily with the precision that the laser cutting affords us, to where the parts fit very well mechanically together and derive a lot of their strength from their mechanical interface versus relying strictly on the glue itself. So we can get away with using a lot of brittle CA glue and rapidly put together structures. When you get into scratch building, and even on some of our kit products, you get into some areas that are high stress or high vibration, or wing spars, where a spar and shear web bond together, that's going to be a high stress joint. Motor mount, they could potentially see a lot of vibration on like a combustion type motor. It'll certainly see quite a bit of vibration. And on an electric motor, if you have a prop out of balance, you're going to see vibration there. Brittle glues such as CA don't tend to hold up well in those applications, and you probably want to think about using epoxy or a wood glue in those areas. I know I'm missing a few things, and I'm gonna gloss over the Ambroid and the Duco cement. Ambroid's been difficult to source, and the cements I tend to use only in free flight glider construction and fiberglassing. But those three main types of glue take into account where the product's going to be used at on the model, and go from there. Make your decisions based on that.
I've got a couple of things I could add to that. There's a kind of glue that I grew up with, PVA, which other people know as white glue. It's not quite the same thing as Nalathotic. It's a polyvinyl acetate glue. Has some very similar properties to Nalathotic. There is actually one very good product on the market called Speed Bond, manufactured by Dulux, which I use quite extensively. In fact, it's my preferred glue whenever I've got the time to wait for it to set. Usually, if you're going to use a glue like that, you want to use it in a situation where you're fixturing your parts so that they can't move for 10, 15, 20 minutes while the glue sets. Another glue that's also very useful, particularly for people that have an allergy or hate the smell of CA glues, is another one of Dulux's products called Superfatic, which has some of the properties of super glue and some of the properties of Nalathotic glue. Very good glue, and I carry it if anybody's interested.
Yeah, I'd say both those guys covered it very well, especially with using epoxy under vibration or high stress areas like wing spars, joining wings together, firewalls, landing gear mounts, things like that, where it's going to see a lot more stress in the CA glues would tend to fracture.
Thank you. Thank you all for providing a great answer for that. And to kind of build upon that, another one of our listeners asked about the best way to prolong the shelf life of CA. I know I personally have found putting it in the refrigerator helps. Do any of you have any other tips on prolonging CA?
Put the cap back on the bottle.
Absolutely. go ahead, Mark.
Go. Most people just leave it sitting on their bench. And basically, one of the agents that's a terrific accelerator for CA is humidity. So the more humidity in your atmosphere, the faster it's going to go off. You daren't leave a bottle lying around in Michigan during the summer with the cap off. It'll be useless next week.
Absolutely. So get yourself some CA tips, some CA extender tips, which are a good thing to have on hand anyway, especially for the thinner CAs. And you'll put that CA tip on your CA glue that has maybe a 4 to 6 inch extension, a narrow tube basically. And if it plugs up, you just chop off a half inch and go ahead and use it. And the good thing is when that end plugs up, it keeps your bottle of glue from going stale.
Excellent. We're going to go back just for a second to covering. We got a good question from one of our listeners. It says, I was taught to cover from bottom to top and rear to front to try to cover any seams. Is this correct, or is there other rules to use?
I'll take that. It very much depends on the model that you're covering. There's no hard and fast rule as to what you should do. You just want to make sure that the seams end up in places that they are hidden by the structure. It's kind of nice to have the seam on the bottom of the trailing edge of the wing rather than the top, for example, just because it looks better. But there's no hard and fast rule.
I think I'll add a few comments to that. I think a lot of that also comes from, back in the day with FAA planes, I used to fly those as a kid. They would slime up the airplane quite well, so we'd always make sure that our seams overlapped with the edge of the seam downwind from the fuel or exhaust goo that was running down the wing. That way it wouldn't be encouraged to kind of get in and under the edge of the covering and start to lift it up to work on the solvent, work on the adhesives in the covering. So I think that's where a lot of that advice comes from.
Yeah, I'd pretty much agree with Bill. I mean, there are times I'll cover the sides of fuselages first, or the top, or the bottom. It depends on the plane itself, or how the side merges onto the top, or whether there's a round turtle deck. But a lot of what I do is by looks, hiding the seams on the bottom.
Perfect. Let's go to a general building question. Obviously, in our October issue, we were suggesting that people who enjoy building, give them new projects, or people who haven't tried it to take on a project. So one of the questions we got from Bruce says, I really want to get started in building, but I have no experience. Where do you suggest I start?
I'd suggest you start with one of our kits. and the reason being is this. Yes, of course, that there's a selfish motivation between that, or with that, with all of us producing kits. But we design our kits to be as easy as it possibly is to build. They require a fraction of the time of the kits of yesteryear, where you had to cut stringers and everything else. A lot of our kits now are 3D jigsaw puzzles with instructions, so you don't have to figure out where everything goes. And as long as you follow directions, a lot of our structures can be built without a single drop of glue. So you'll have an entire wing built sitting in front of you. You can pick it up, and you haven't glued it yet. So you can check everything. Everything fits together like it's supposed to be. We do an insane amount of hours in designing it to be easy to build, proper structure, test it, have other people test build it. So we've tried to make it as easy as it possibly is. Now, that said, somebody getting into it right off the beginning is saying, I don't have the skills, and that is one of the problems, but the skills aren't hard to learn. You can do research on Google, RC groups, or any web-based forums for little things you might not know, like how to use the glue, how to cover, things like that. It's not as intimidating as it seems when you're first starting out saying, there's so much. Basically, you just have to start and just go with it. And it's not hard. It's just a learning process like any skill that you've learned throughout your entire life.
A couple of things to add to that. Not just Mountain Models laser cut kits, but any laser cut kit that's been well designed, they'll make some designs and make some great kits. So do we at RetroRC. And there are others out there. Get yourself a good laser cut kit and don't be too ambitious with your first build. Don't try a scale model, for example. Try something that looks like a traditional old-fashioned model. They're usually much easier to build, much easier to fly.
Yeah, I want to throw in my two cents. I want to agree with Mark here as well, that starting with a simple kit and a simple shape, look for kits or builds that would feature a square wing, square fuselage, not just from a sticking it up standpoint that it's going to be easier to identify when things are out of square, but also you're going to have to cover this model. And if you're an entry-level builder, this is going to be your first covering job as well. And so keeping a simple build going will ensure having a simple covering job. One of the things that building a kit is going to do for you that, if this is your first go-around with building and you were going to try to build from scratch, well, you'd need to have some information in front of you for selecting the appropriate sheet wood to use and the appropriate stick wood to use. And you may not, you may have not developed those skills in selecting the wood yet. And a good kit manufacturer, any kit manufacturer for that matter, should be putting their kits together with an eye towards that and pre-selecting the proper weight, grain, et cetera, of sheet wood and stick wood that you would end up using in the build. The other thing a kit is going to do for you is, again, a well-thought-out kit is going to often teach you some build skills, but in the instructions for those kits, you'll also tend to glean some nuggets of knowledge out of them. A kit maker tends to use their kits as an instructional teaching tool to kind of build upon each skill from, as you start with an easy to build kit, we'll teach you a few skills, and as you move up to more intermediate type kits, there'll tend to be other nuggets of information that you'll pick up, and really if you do a couple of kits, get a couple, two, three kits under your belt, you'll start to really get the idea how these model airplanes go together, realize that It isn't rocket science. It's just good old-fashioned know-how and engineering, and you're not going to be timid when it comes to selecting a good scratch build or short kit or whatever that next project is. And so it's good to see what other people have done and kind of build upon that for yourself. I think you'll find it a lot more enjoyable than just starting out with a box of wood and a bundle of sticks and a knife.
A couple of other things just to add to that. You'll find if you ask around, ask Bill, ask Brian, ask myself, some of our kits are actually designed specifically for novices. I'll give you an example of that. The Camp E-Racer, which is a little radio control airplane that we produce, was designed specifically for a one-day workshop where novices were invited to come in, build their first model airplane, and fly it on the same day. So some kits are actually designed with the novice in mind. And if you chat with the manufacturers or some of the hobby shop store owners, you'll find out which ones they are.
Absolutely. And don't forget that from us or any manufacturer, if you have questions, ask. We love helping people get into this. We like explaining things. If you don't know what an X-Acto is, and don't laugh. We've had that question before. We can explain things to you. We can help you out. We can give you tips when you call or if you get stuck saying, I don't know how to do this. Ask. There's plenty of people out there to help.
That's a great point, and thank you all for your answers. And we're going to go to our next question, which actually comes from Model Aviation's previous editor, Michael Ramsey. He asks, are there any considerations with airspeed when choosing covering? In other words, will lightweight covering work at high airspeeds?
Yes, there are considerations to consider in that. No, you're not going to be flying a framed model with so light going 150 miles an hour, that's for sure.
Anybody else want to add?
I'd absolutely agree. It depends on the strength of the structure underneath. There's a lot of people rely on the film to impart a lot of torsional rigidity to the wing. Especially in park flyer construction, where you see more of a ladder style to the wing assembly, where you have leading edge, trailing edge, spar, and ribs laid out in kind of a ladder formation. That's a pretty twisty wing until you get the covering on it. A lot of our glider guys out there simply won't cover their glider wings in a very light fabric like Aerolite because it just doesn't have the torsional rigidity that heavier films like Ultracoat or Monocoat would offer. So when selecting your film and the speed and the stresses that the airframe is going to see, select accordingly. If you're relying on film to impart strength to the structure, then you need a pretty stout film. So that's an excellent question.
One other thing to add to that, full-size aircraft which fly at 180 miles an hour are covered in fabric sometimes. However, I would say for a model, if you're going to fly a model that's a 100 mile an hour plus airplane, you want to have a sheeted structure and probably want to have it covered with fiberglass to add a lot of strength and rigidity to the aircraft. You don't want anything fluttering.
Yeah, flutter is the death knell for any airplane. And using a lightweight covering or inappropriate structure is going to lead to that. So definitely on higher speed planes, you want composite covering or solid wing or sheeted wing that's then painted, things like that.
Okay, we're going to take just a quick break here for a moment to allow our listeners to answer a question that should be popping up here for you momentarily. It's going to be a poll about how would you rate your workshop. One is spacious, stocked with lots of tools. Two is it's enough to tackle most projects. Three, I could use more space or tools. Or four, a workshop, what's that? So we'll give everyone just a moment here to complete that poll.
Sorry, guys, doesn't look like we get to vote as panelists.
Well, while we're taking a minute for everyone else, why don't you tell us how you would vote?
Let's see. I could always use more room and tools, always, because I never have enough room for anything, and what guy out there has enough tools?
It's going to be my answer too, Brian.
What about Bill? What's your answer?
I just built a barn, and so as I went through building the barn, it was an excuse to buy a tool about weekly, so you could never have enough tools. So,
but you do have enough space.
Well, now I've run out of space to store the tools, so I might have to build another barn. And thus the cycle repeats itself.
Well, let me share for our listeners, the winning answer is it's enough to tackle most projects, closely followed by I could use more space or tools. All right, well, thank you for taking the poll, and we're going to go right to Mark for our next question because I think he would be the perfect person to answer this. This is from Frank Geisler. When scratch building, what's the best way to keep the fuselage straight or even? The fuselage sometimes twists or warps.
Well, thank you for that vote of confidence, Jay. I have a favorite method for keeping my fuselages from becoming the banana boats they used to be whenever I was a novice builder. I have a building jig system which provides some vertical members that will hold your fuselage sides vertical. And they're aligned with a carbon rod. So using a jig assembled from parts like that, you can keep your fuselage as straight as your building board is flat, basically. Building jigs are the answer. Anybody
okay.
else want to add something to that?
Sure, I'll add something to that. Take advantage of CA glues, specifically a medium CA glue with a fine tip applicator. And as you're putting your fuselage together, simply tack glue the fuselage together and inspect it for square as you go along. There's obviously when you're scratch building, there's going to be no substitute for having a nice jig to hold things good and square. But if you're like me and you scratch build without a jig kind of over top of the plans, you can square it up, tack it into place, evaluate it from several different angles, and then when you're satisfied with it, go ahead and thoroughly bond your parts.
Okay. The next question, there were several questions that related to picking the right power system for an aircraft. And obviously, when you all design your models, that's something that you think about. Could you maybe touch on briefly what you used to determine what the right power system is for your models? I mean, obviously, some of it's testing, but some of our readers are asking if they're working on a project, the best way to determine that.
Sure. Now, this is a discussion on electric power system or just a,
yes,
you know,
yes,
general?
On an electric power system.
Okay. Well, I'm happy to jump in there. Essentially, it's all about power loading, and I'll throw out a few numbers. I think they're pretty widely accepted. You want to take into account an estimated completed airframe weight. So if you have any means to estimate or continue to kind of estimate as you start adding equipment up, we got to figure out what our airplane is going to come out and weigh. And if that's let's just take an easy subject here. It's a 1 pound airplane. It's generally accepted that for a 1 pound airplane, 50 watts for 1 pound of airplane flying weight is considered the bare minimum required to fly. I wouldn't expect it to ROG out of the grass there. It's probably going to require a hand launch, and it's going to be able to get around the pattern at 50 watts per pound, but it's not going to be terribly exciting. I think a lot of our trainer aircraft that we build, we turn out numbers much closer to 70 watts per pound, and that's going to produce an airplane that will readily taxi out, take off the ground on its own power, get around the pattern, have a decent or reasonable rate of climb. If you're building a sport airplane and you want to put it through, your typical IMAC maneuvers, with 100 watts per pound, you should be able to fly the entire IMAC basic sequence. The airplane's going to carry, into a loop readily from level. It'll have a nice long vertical upline. It's not going to have unlimited vertical at 100 watts per pound, but it's not going to be wanting. for those guys that are building 3D airplanes, this number keeps going up because I think we're real power hungry. But it, generally, 130 watts per pound was enough to fly 3D, hover the airplane, and just kind of eke out a reasonable rate of climb out of a hover. 3D is much better flown with 150 to 200 watts per pound to where you can now, you know, stop the airplane, hover, open it wide open, and accelerate like a rocket vertically. So kind of keep those numbers in mind, and they'll apply from everything from your gymnasium flyer up to much larger 30% you know, size models, and even applies in the real world. So to full-size aircraft. So keep those power loading figures in mind as you're designing, and it doesn't hurt to, you know, scour the manufacturer pages and develop a list of motors, their weights, and their associated power outputs. But I know it can be quite confusing, especially with electric, because you have you're presented with a lot of information on volts and amps and things of that nature. It always helps just to look at the watts. So to take your volts, multiply it times your amps, and get your watts and start classifying all of your product, all the motors that you come across in terms of their rated power output in watts. And that'll let you kind of work back from your selected motor to airframe and make sure that the motor you select will have the right power loading for your application.
Just to add a little bit to what Bill's just said, the power that is quoted by a manufacturer for the electric motors is normally the maximum continuous power that you could safely draw from the motor without damaging the motor. It doesn't actually tell you how much power you're going to get whenever you put that in your airframe. You should invest in a watt meter so that you can actually measure the power that the propeller you're trying to fly your airplane with on that motor is giving you. Also, it's important to choose a prop and motor combination that is suitable for the flying speed of your aircraft. If you're flying something or going to be flying something that's relatively slow, you probably want to have a lower KV rating on the motor. If you're going to fly something that's going to be traveling fairly quickly, you might want a higher KV on the motor and fly it with a smaller prop.
Absolutely. Both those guys are exactly where you are. Start out with your total watts required and then look at your KV requirements, because you're not going to want a motor, you know, 100-watt motor spinning, say, 20,000 RPM with a small 5-inch prop is not going to fly your 48-inch cup, and vice versa, you know. So start out with total watts and then look at your KV rating, figure out what size, or to use your appropriate prop and prop speed.
Right, and also, you know, I'll add, we're now many, many years into the resurgence of interest in electric, and it looks like it's here to stay at this point. The kind of information now that's available from manufacturers, any good manufacturer is going to have several examples given of their motor with a given battery pack and a given propeller and the amount of power that you should expect to see out of it. So if you're selecting a high-quality motor, say, from the likes of Hacker, eFlight has done a great job of documenting their motors. I'm sure there are many, many others out there that have done a good job as well. And I'm by neglecting to mention them by name, I'm not disavowing them. But look, a lot of the manufacturers have done their homework, and they've provided a lot of this information that will help you make that determination. So you'll have a good idea of what size prop you'll end up with, and that's also going to help weed out certain motors that wouldn't be appropriate based upon prop clearance issues.
It's also a good idea whenever you're selecting your power system to make sure that you choose a electronic speed controller that is capable of delivering a lot more current than the motor is capable of consuming on a continuous basis. Reason for that is if the motor stalls, it will instantaneously draw a huge current way more than you normally would expect it to draw. So I tend to up the size of the speed controller versus what the minimum would be for that motor at its power rating.
Excellent responses. Thank you so much for covering that. And we're going to go back a little bit to working with wood. We have a question from Nick who wants to know, what's the best way to cut and bend 1/16 inch balsa without crushing it?
I'll go ahead and do part of that. The first, I guess, it depends on your application. If you're using the 16th inch wood to cover, say, a turtleneck or something with a curved shape, use a Windex or a light spray like that on the outside of the balsa, and that'll relieve the stresses on that side of the wood and help it form around whatever you're trying. Let that dry, and there you go. If you're for cutting it, a nice sharp number 11 X-Acto blade for thin balsa woods, or you know, if you're going up to plywood, go ahead and use, you know, a bandsaw or jigsaw, whatever. But for thin, lightweight balsa, a very nice, very sharp X-Acto blade that you should replace as often as you can.
Another thing I could add to that, if you want to create a fairly tight curve, one of the projects that I used to teach kids, 11-year-old kids, one of the school projects, was to soak your sheet of 1/16 balsa wood in warm water for maybe 10, 15, or up to 20 minutes. Some people will say add ammonia to the water. That is not necessary, and it's very stinky. Soak the wood till it's absolutely saturated. Then you can wrap 1/16 of an inch wood around a half inch former relatively easily without cracking it, as long as you're using a grain wood.
Yes.
The choice of the wood is the important key point. The kids wrapping their balsa wood tubes, they would then bind a bandage, like a roll bandage around it, leave it overnight to dry, and when you take the roll bandage off, you've got a tube that's permanently bent.
Thank you.
Yeah, I apologize for neglecting the grain type, because you're not going to be bending sea grain balsa wood.
Right.
Well, this may fall slightly outside of building. We just received a question if any of you three gentlemen balance your props, and if so, if you have any tips on balancing props.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. No, you should balance your props. I'll be honest and say there are times I don't because I'm in a hurry or whatever, but it does put more stress on your motor, on the bearings in your motors, and you don't want that to happen. So balance your props, pick up a good quality prop balancer like one of the Dubros. That's what I use in my shop, and it works perfectly fine. Always balance your props, though. And, yes, I know we don't always do it, but it is a very good practice to get in. It'll extend the life of your motor. You'll have less vibration over your entire airframe, and it's just generally a good practice.
Patience. A lot of patience if you want to have a finely balanced prop with no vibration. But I will say that modern manufacturers of props are way better than they used to be. Many of the props you can take right out of the bag and they're almost perfectly balanced. For example, the APC props are exceptionally well pre-balanced.
Yeah, and I'd like to add a couple different ways to balance. Obviously, you can work on the heavy end with some sandpaper and take off bits of the prop or some thickness of the prop. When I've been in a bind and need to get a balanced prop on my plane quickly, given that I'm flying electric, there's no fuels involved, a little bit of Scotch tape on the lightweight blade, on the back side of the blade, it hangs in there just fine, again, because no fuel is involved with an electric model. The fuel's not going to act as a solvent, get under there and cause that to come off in flight. So you can put a bit of weight on the prop, and it'll stay around for the life of the model if you want it to, or just until you get back to the shop and can do a little better job of working the prop over for balance. But that's a quick tip for getting a quick balance on a prop.
Excellent.
Another thing that you can do is you can either use a varnish or paint. Particularly if you're building the scale model, I often will paint the propeller, and you just add a little bit more paint to the light blade.
Perfect. How about Terrence asks, he says that he has difficulty when trying to make a beveled edge, most often for his ailerons. Is there any tips on how to make that consistent?
Absolutely. Get two steel rulers, nice thin steel or aluminum rulers. Put down one ruler, your aileron on top of that, and lay your second steel ruler on top of that, set back an appropriate distance for your bevel angle. Take a nice flat block, sanding block, and go right down the side holding the rulers in place. The rulers stop your sanding block, and you end up with a nice straight line all the way down.
I could add another very quick tip to that. If the exact angle that you're trying to get isn't critical, but you just want to get a uniform bevel all the way along the straight edge of the leading edge of your control surface, if you put your control surface upside down on top of a what I call a sanding board, which is a flat piece of board that's got sandpaper glued to it, the sandpaper stops your part from moving around. Set the edge of your piece right up against the edge of the board, and then you can lean your sanding bar or block of wood with sandpaper that you're using against the edge of the board as you sand backwards and forwards, and that makes it much easier to control the sanding without having to specially fixture it up with rulers like Brian suggests.
Excellent tips. How about we've got a question here from Jeff. He says, is the silk and dope covering method worth the time and effort to learn now, and will it provide me a nice long-lasting finish? Anyone?
I'll take it. Silk is beautiful when it's finished. There is nothing that looks quite like silk. It will last a very long time, but it is a lot more work for a finished model. It's going to take you longer. It's kind of a longer learning curve. But is it worth learning? Absolutely. It's worth learning any additional technique you can to put in your toolbox. So I'd say go ahead and give it a try. Try it out. See if you like it, see if you like your finished product, and keep in mind that it's going to take you a little practice to get good with it, but it is a beautiful finishing technique.
Absolutely. However, if you are going to use silk, you need to make sure that you've got a well-ventilated area that you can work in, because you're going to be using dope and with all the solvents, etc., that you're going to be evaporating. You don't want to be doing that inside the house. If you are restricted and you still want to get a nice fabric-like finish, you can use one of the iron-on fabric films like Solartex, which gives you an excellent finish and a very durable model. I actually have a powerhouse, which is a 84-inch wingspan model that was designed in 1937. My particular one was built in 1986, covered in Solartex, and I still fly that model with the original covering.
Yeah, I was going to add to that. I don't ever remember working with dope in a well-ventilated area, and maybe that's because the area wasn't well-ventilated.
And so. Maybe that's why your airplane ended up with pink polka dots afterwards.
So yeah, make sure you get the window open.
Another question has just popped up, was about painting on covering. Have any of you had experience in that, and do you have any tips or specific types of paints that you found work good to paint on covering?
Well, if we're talking about plastic film covering, I'm going to pass on that one because I prefer not to use plastic films.
I haven't had perfect yeah, take it, Bill.
Take it. Yeah, I'm probably going the same place you're going, Brian. A lot of the paints don't adhere great to plastic covering, but you can do some prep work to the covering that will certainly make it stick and stay on at, you know, with normal encounters with the weeds and the scrub at the field. basically I take some double off steel wool, I'll mask off an area on the model that I want to paint, and I'll mask it off. I'll take some double off steel wool, and I'll generally rough up that area, treat the area with alcohol to make sure there's no residual oils or anything residue wise on the covering. And then I've had best luck with fairly rapid drying and aggressive type lacquers. So find like a lacquer type spray paint, and I'll shoot that on there in a very light coat to start with, and then just kind of build up in several layers. And I've had models with paint over top of covering last quite some time that way. I will say that while it's difficult to scratch the paint off or have weeds scratch the paint off, if you apply a sticker over the painted area and have to lift the sticker to reposition it, it has no problem coming, lifting that paint right off with it. So, paint over plastic can be tricky, and so just keep that in mind that as you apply stickers, it may lift your paint if you have to pull that sticker back up.
Yeah, and with Bill, what Bill said, I've had the exact results that he does. But you can always use, say, a silver and aluminum base film. That way, if paint does chip off, well, it looks like you have some metal underneath that fabric.
Good point.
Great. Well, scale model.
Our time's almost up. It's hard to believe an hour's gone by. But before we close, I want to give each one of you an opportunity just to provide any other information that maybe we haven't touched on, maybe one last tip to our listeners. So I'll leave it to you and who wants to go first, and we'll continue through all three.
I'll give one. There was one of the questions in the questions that you sent us earlier about painting foam. I tend, if I'm doing a foam model, not to paint the whole of the model, but just paint some markings on the model. One technique that works really well is to cut yourself a cardboard stencil and then use an acrylic craft kind of paint and stipple through the stencil. Great for doing scale racing numbers and that kind of thing on the model.
Thanks, Mark.
Thank you.
Bill O'Brien?
Sure. Go ahead, Brian. Bill. All right, I'll go.
Oh, okay.
You first. No. What I'd say is just in generally, building is not something that should be looked at as intimidating. It's not that hard to do. If there are hundreds or a thousand or however many girls over in China building kits, then you can do it as well. It's not something that's hard. It's just a small skill set that needs to be built up, and you can gain those skills. And as far as time goes, people may say that it takes too much time or whatever, but there's everything you do in your life takes time. If you want to try it, just try it. You can do it while watching TV, listen to the radio, teach your kids, and build up these skills and pass these skills on to your children. And they're going to be, you're going to have more of a sense of accomplishment by building than you are buying something that's already ready to go.
Thanks, Brian. Bill?
Yeah, I'll just add to that. I mean, I'd echo quite a bit of what Brian said. The other benefit to this, of course, is if you've got a few model builds under your belt, that when you do break down in a weak moment and buy that shiny new ARF, take it out to the field and crack it up, you'll have no problem ripping into it to repair it, get it back to flying shape. Absolutely. Don't be intimidated by building. And if you're listening and you are a builder, grab the neighbor kid and get them involved and instill in them a lifetime love of model building.
Thank you, Bill. Well, once again, I'd like to thank our panel. We have Brian Eberween of Mountain Models, Mark Freeland of Retro RC, and Bill Stevens of Stevens Aero Models for joining us today. Today's podcast was provided by the Academy of Model Aeronautics and Model Aviation Magazine. If you'd like to learn more about the AMA, call 1-800 iFlyAMA or visit us at www.modelaircraft.org. As a reminder, this entire podcast will be available for you to listen to again at www.modelaviation.com. Also, at modelaviation.com, we'll have the links to all three of these gentlemen's websites. So if you didn't catch that information, we'll have links directly to their website, and you can check out all their great products. I'm Jay Smith, editor-in-chief of Model Aviation Magazine, signing off. Thank you.